Mr. Mike Hall, Reel 5. Now, one thing that happens is you were given a Bren gun to operate during this period in these trenches around the perimeter. Can you tell us a bit about that and how you managed with that?
Well, I managed all right. I mean, it was no problem. Not that I used it all that much, but I remember in the evening, during the day I had it, there was a... in the woods to the left of our trench, which was full of Germans, and there was a lot of noise coming from them chatting. So I pointed the Bren to where the noise was coming from and fired a complete round in their direction. There were no more noises after that. But what happened to them, I've no idea. They may have just used their sense and kept quiet.
Taught a lesson about them.
Pardon?
They were taught a lesson.
Yes, that's right, yes. And the next morning, that was the end. I handed it back and picked up my rifle again.
Now, what happened next then, that next morning?
Well, it was just a matter of, you know, keeping an eye open. And we moved around a bit. If it was thought necessary that one part of the perimeter wanted a reinforcement, we moved around amongst chaps of other regiments. The real occurrence that I remember, because it was just a matter of keeping watch, but I was in this trench with this young chap, and it wasn't a particularly good trench, because one end was partly obscured, you know, the vision, by a bush. And we were in this trench, and this young chap said to me, he said, "Sarge, have a look here. I can see something." And a split second later, just before I'd moved, this chap was shot right through the heart.
By a sniper?
Which, I must say, concentrated the mind. And it was just a matter of, you know, he was obviously dead. Blood was coming out of his mouth. So a colleague who... this was on a bit of a slope, and a colleague of mine, which was a little bit lower, he assisted me in just taking this poor chap down to the lower level.
Now, one thing is, the third lift, this Tuesday the 19th, September, we haven't done that yet. What do you remember about that?
Well, not a lot, really, because at that time we were around the Div HQ, you know, doing our main job, and then moving out to the perimeter, so that although we saw them coming in...
What could you see?
Well, you saw the tug and the gliders coming in and just releasing, paratroops coming down. Some of the tugs circled around to drop supplies. But as the perimeter decreased, as the area that we were, you know, covering decreased, a lot of the supplies were just dropped into the German territory, as it were.
Now, so what happens? What do you remember? I mean, what sort of attack were you under? Why was the perimeter decreasing? I mean, or were you just conforming to other people, or were you actually under attack?
It was mostly attack mortar fire coming over.
What was it like in the German mortar fire then? Because people have no idea.
No, not very pleasant, because you don't know the darn thing's coming. And there it is. As I say, I think I always said my second pilot had a mortar shell in his trench, and that was the end of him. But although I wasn't near him at the time... But that's the kind of thing, because they come down, you know, vertically. But it was just a general sniping and hearing a lot of battles going on.
So it's more that you were on the fire, you were being forced out by the scope
of the
mortar
fire. That's right, yes. I mean, the territory that we were in was gradually being pressed back.
Now, what...
And then... during that, we call it a retreat, if you like, but it was only a retreat of a short distance, we moved to some houses right on the outskirts of Oosterbeek, lovely houses which we occupied and set up observation posts up in the upper rooms, you know, the bedrooms.
What could you see from up there?
Not a lot, because there were other houses in front of us. We knew they were there because a few mortars or shells or whatever landed on these houses. So when we left, there were quite a few holes in the walls.
Were you doing any fire? Was there anyone to fire at, or were you just occupied?
No, just keeping a lookout. If somebody was there, well, obviously we would have fired. You know what? But we didn't see anybody, at least that I remember.
You were living in the cellar, I believe.
Yes, to get a bit of rest, we went down into this cellar and managed to get a bit of sleep and a bit of food down there, which the poor residents of the house had made all this bottled fruit, which was very welcome to us. And then...
any incidents you remember?
Yes, the lady that lived in the house appeared, and she wanted to remove some article if she could. Very nice lady, with the house battered about and us eating half of her bottled fruit. She, you know, didn't complain whatsoever. She said, "It's, you know, nice to see you, but don't worry, it's not your fault," kind of attitude. And off she went. I think it was a painting she wanted off the wall, which fortunately was okay. Where she went to for the rest of the battle, I've no idea. But it was very sad, and no doubt she must have been very dismayed at the sight of her house with holes in the wall and the roof.
And what state were you in? You were still with Wally, weren't you?
I was still with Wally then.
Yes. What state were the pair of you in?
Well, you know, all right, as far as that goes, what can you do? You've just got to live by the minute, really. You never knew.
So what happened?
But there again, as I said before, one doesn't think that one's going to be killed. It's a strange quirk of nature, I suppose.
And then, towards the, 24th? You seem to have been in the houses quite a long time.
We were in the houses, yes.
How long do you think?
2 or 3 days, I suppose. But then on the... we arrived on the 17th. The day before we evacuated, Wally was called over to the flight HQ and told about the evacuation procedure, which was going to take place that evening. Any...
So that would be the evening of the 24th?
Well, whatever the last day was, I can't remember. No, it was a bit later than that, because we arrived on the 17th, and we were there 7 or 8 days. So it must be... Well, yes, I suppose it's round about that time, because we went out that evening.
25th.
Yes. We went out that evening with a minimum of kit.
What would you carry?
Obviously, you carry your rifle and destroy any other weapons that may be about that couldn't then be used. We had to muffle our feet because this was at night time that we were going to evacuate. And at a certain time, we all set off. And the arrangement was to meet on a big open, when I say open, a grass area that did have some cover with trees, but I remember we were halfway across this open area and everything hell let loose. We all flung ourselves to the ground and just waited. That was the only time I felt anything hit me must have been a bit of shrapnel on my on the gaiters that we wore, you know, around the bottom of our trousers. That's as near as I came to any damage, which is very lucky. And then we slowly made our way past the divisional headquarters which was still full of German POWs, and they were complaining and moaning that what are we going to do, you know, you can't leave us here kind of thing, to which we thought, well, that's your hard luck. And we had to make our way down through the woods. And it wasn't a very nice night. It was raining, as it would. And the path through the woods had been taped out with the white tape. Where they got the white tape, who knows. But some of our chaps had been given the duty of marking out this path through the trees right down to the riverbanks, where we just had to wait under quite a bit of fire. Although the Germans had an idea exactly where we were, fortunately, a lot of their fire, missed the area, but there was enough to be pretty hot. And we just waited there. And at that time, I think it was the Dorset Regiment, had reached the other side of the riverbank. And they...
This is the river, the Rhine?
The Rhine. Lower Rhine, Niederrhein, I think they called it. And they were ferrying in these little boats and picking up. They weren't, I suppose the most of it you got on the boat was about 14 or 15 minutes of time, which wasn't a lot. And they were ferrying very bravely across and back across the river. And one just waited until... The queue you were in, and then you jumped. And so that was how we got away. A lot of chaps didn't wait for the boats, and they tried to swim the river. Wally tried to swim it, but didn't get far. I think he was with somebody who was injured. But they returned, and he managed to get across eventually. But I think quite a few drowned and were swept away when they tried to get across.
Did your boat come under fire as you crossed?
Not particularly, no, that I remember. We just kept a low profile. And
now what happened when you got to the other side?
At the other side there was a reception thing, and we were guided to a reception area where I don't know if details were taken, but there was a bit of food for us, which was very welcome. As far as I remember, it was a nice hot stew. And after that, we were taken by lorry to... Now, where's the place? You'll have to remind me.
Nijmegen.
Into, I think it was a school, empty school, where more details were taken so that they knew... who was there. And that's where I met up with on Wally again.
So you were well treated?
Yes, they did all they could. And with more food, of course. And then at this time we were pretty scruffy. And Wally and I decided that we'd walk into Nijmegen, because it was fairly quiet at that time, to see if we could get a shave and a haircut. And we wandered past one barber's shop, which was shut. So we thought, well, that's no good, and walked on a bit more and saw another one. And fortunately, at the door of this one, the lady of the house was there. And although he was shut, this chap very obligingly opened up and gave us a bit of a tidy up. And then we walked back, but I suppose there again, Lady Luck plays its part. Whilst we were walking back, we heard there was a bit of a rumpus somewhere, shells forming. And so we obviously didn't hurry. But then we then passed this first shop that we saw, which had a direct hit. So that's fate, I suppose.
Now, what happened next then?
Then we returned, and spent that second night in a different, they moved us from this school to another place. For what reason, I have no idea. And we had the night there. Then the next morning, they wanted an advance party to go back to England. Wally and I were chosen for some reason or other, although I did have a word in the ear of our flight commander who was doing the choosing. And off we were taken to this airfield and hoped that a Dakota would arrive to fly us out. And we waited there for quite some time, and the chap in charge, the officer in charge, decided that this was no good, it's getting a bit late, we'd better go back. But at that moment, in came a Dakota. So we all jumped on board, and the pilot decided that he'd got too many on. And it was a choice of, one of just a few getting off. And the officer said to Wally and I, well, one of you have got to get off. So we tossed. Poor old Wally lost. Not that it made a lot of difference. And off we flew back to the UK, dropping, as we were all different regiments and different stations, dropping as near as possible to where they had to go. Of course, ours being an airfield was okay, but we were about the last to get dropped off back at Blakehill Farm. And naturally we got rid of our equipment in the thing and went in down into the mess where the chaps were waiting. They wanted to hear everything had gone on and could we remember any of those that wouldn't come back.
How did you feel about the casualties? How many were the casualties and how did you feel about it?
Well, we didn't know. We knew of a certain, during round our particular area of the battle that had gone, but how many, of course, we had no idea. We could only tell them of the ones that we knew who had actually been killed. Of course, a lot had been wounded and captured as well, so we didn't know that at the time. But it was after, when the next day, when all the rest of them returned, and you went to your billet, and you realised that there were quite a few empty beds.
Did that depress the unit, or were they all right?
Well, it was all right, because, it happens in war, but obviously you were sad that to realise that that chap there, he's finished, he's gone.
So what happened next? What was the next move? There weren't any more glider operators?
No. It was just a matter of, settling down again. I think we were given some leave.
Were you at the same place?
Yes.
At Blake,
yes. Yeah.
And did anything change? Did they change the training methods or bring in any new lessons to reflect what had happened at Arnhem, or was it just...
Well, no, not at that. Well, I suppose there would have been, but shortly afterwards, there was the question of the Far East. And they asked, because this was, September, and they asked for volunteers who would go out to India. Now, the rule of the army is never volunteer, but Wally and I did.
Now, why?
Well, we just thought it would be a bit different. It certainly turned out. So that in December we were...
Now, hang on, just before that, you also seem to have gone on a refresher course. North Luffnam.
North Luffnam,
what
yes.
What was that about?
Well, just to give us a bit more, a bit of flying.
Was it flying or gliding?
Gliding. Nothing specific, but just to keep our hands in, as it were. We weren't there very long.
So you just stayed, you were at Blakehill Farm till and North Luffnam?
Yes.
That's just a course?
Yes.
Till December?
Till December.
What happened then?
Then we found out that we were going out to India. The exact details I can't remember, but eventually the group that were going assembled down at, where did we take off from? Can't remember that.
Down in Essex, it looks like. Ah,
Brem, yes, that's right. Yes, on a mushroom farm, that's right. We slept amongst the mushrooms for a few days. And we were issued with certain, dress for the Far East.
What kind of dress?
Tropical kit, with khaki, just light khaki. No pith helmets.
Was it better for the? I mean, what did you think of your tropical kit?
Oh, it was very comfortable, and a bit smarter than the old battle dress. And we waited there. One lot took off. The first batch took off, and they had a disaster. They crashed in the Pyrenees, apparently, and lost quite a lot of chaps. Although we moaned at the time that we'd missed the first lift, we were very glad once again. I must have had an angel on my shoulder. But eventually we did. Why we didn't go by Dakota, I don't know, but we went down to Poole in Dorset. Now, we were taken to Victoria Station in London and taken by Pullman car. So this was a life of luxury for a short while, because we were flying out from Poole Harbour on a Sunderland flying boat, which, although it sounds a bit incongruous at that time, was flown by civilian pilots. It was a forerunner of BOA. So we went to this hotel in Poole Harbour, which is now quite a five-star hotel, and we were treated more or less as civilians. We'd had a very good time. You know, we were woken up in bed with tea and nice meals. And this was just before Christmas. We were due to fly out on Christmas Eve. Woken up in the morning. And this went down to the quay, got on the pilot, had a word with him. He said, "Look, this is Christmas Eve." He said, "Don't worry, chaps," he said. "We're not going to miss Christmas." So we were taken out to this amazing machine and settled in, and off the old thing. We circled the harbour at Poole and then took off.
What was it like then, this great big flight?
Oh, it was wonderful. We didn't have any comforts, you know. There were no proper seats and things. We just lay about where we could. Very interesting. You looked through the porthole as you were taking off and saw the waves. An experience. And we circled the, after we'd become airborne, we circled the area and down we came to land, or at least to land in the harbour again. And the pilot said, "No, I'm sorry, there's a fault in one of the engines." So back we went to our hotel, Christmas Eve. Okay, that was very pleasant because you could just relax in the mess. And same was going to happen next day. We were due to take off on Christmas Day. So exactly the same thing happened. Circled round, one circuit of the harbour, down we came. Another engine had gone wrong. So we did spend Christmas Day at the hotel, which he was determined to do. And that was nice because we had a very good meal. But we did take off on the Boxing Day. Not much to report. It was it was a pleasant flight, no trouble. We flew right across, because at that time, I remember France and the Portuguese area was free of any trouble. So we flew across and landed on the Mediterranean at a little posting place, as it was then, called Djerba. I think it's Djerba, Djerba. But all it was a load of tents, lots of camels around, belching away, and the Arabs there were guiding us to this reception area where we just were to spend the night. But once again, this very clever pilot said to us, look, he said, if it's all right with you chaps, I'll just refuel here and we'll fly on through the night to Cairo. Which is what he did. Wonderful chap. And of course we approached Cairo in the morning, and he even did a circuit of the pyramids to show us what they were like from up above. And we landed on the Nile, and then ferried out to a reception area where details were taken, and some so-and-so pinched my cap badge, some Arab, silver one it was as well. And then we were taken down into Cairo to a hotel, not in a particularly nice area, but it was fair enough. Taken up to about the fifth floor where we had a room, and given something to eat, and then we had free time, because we weren't going to do anything for that night. So Wally and I got changed a bit and went into Cairo, which was fairyland, because all the lights were on, there's cafes, and it was really beautiful. And we went into, I wanted to go into the museum to see these wonderful Tutankhamun relics. They're unimaginable to see them, wonderful things. And I've no doubt there was plenty more in the museum that we didn't have the time, but by this time it was getting a bit dark. And the evening was, it was heaven, because it was like a dark blue velvet sky. And on the bridge across the Nile, we just stood and looked at this. A wonderful scene. War was many miles away.